From your era at Gloucester, Don, let's appoint you as, well, you were on the selection panel, of course, as captain. Let's select you at fullback. Who would you choose as your sort of dream team, the 14 in front of you? Who would you have on the wings?
Well, John Groves. Probably Nick Fowk, if... Nick Foy, sorry. If he could have kept his enthusiasm, put it that way, in a bit more check, because he was a big lad, he was very strong. Bayliss and Pitt, without any shadow of doubt, they just put the opposition off. Even the Welsh were a bit sceptical about Bayliss, because Bayliss told me, as he said, he used to always try and put a bit of fear of God into the opposite number, thinking, and he used to run straight at him. Oh, it was marvellous. Oh, Terry Hobson and Mickey Booth, brilliant. Front row. Well, Jackie Falk was very good. Ken Taylor was very good. I probably didn't see the best of Mickey Burton, but clearly he became a very competent player. I'll tell you one story about Mickey Burton. I'd been on the Lions tour and I'd shared a room with all the players at some time. One was Howard Norris of Cardiff, a prop. And Mickey Booth was new in the team. And Mickey thought he'd try something out on Howard. And I knew Howard. Howard was one of these guys. Don't do it. And he did that to Mickey Burton. I thought, oh, God, blimey, he's going to hit him. And sure enough, scrum goes down. Scrum breaks up. Who's lying on the floor? Face down, out, Mickey Burton. Howard Norris had must have chinned him. That's all I can think of. And that was Mickey Burton must have learned an awful lot from that. You would have thought, anyhow, because he did very well. I would probably have him in because he could also change his body position quite a lot. He'd start with his feet quite close to his chest and his shoulders, and then he'd move them back. Now, that often had the effect of the loose head on the other side losing his balance, and Mickey got the ball that way. Or the hooker got the ball that way. Now, that was a sort of fine point. I noticed he did that very well. Alan Brin, definitely in front of the line-out. Whatever with him. Probably Jim Jarrett. Jim Jarrett could play in the back row as well, but Jim Jarrett was quite a lively forward. He's a useful character. Oh, definitely Dick Smith. Robin Cowling, don't forget, at that time came in at 19, so I wasn't seeing the best of him. You know, he's another one. He was at Cirencester, the Royal Agricultural College, and he suddenly appeared. And I really knew nothing about him. And so he was learning the trade. He was a bit like Mickey Burton. But, I mean, Robin Cowling at his best was a walk-in. But I just probably didn't see the best of him. I think he developed as he went on. Then he left Gloucester for Leicester, where he did exceptionally well. Dick Smith, definitely in the back row. Peter, you couldn't play without Peter. Because those arms of his were everywhere. Mm. And he knew the game. He was another one who read the game. He would wander through the line-out, wander back, you know, and making the scrum half doubtful as to whether he was going to club him or not. And he was tall, so he could get the ball in the back of the line-out. Oh, brilliant. Number eight. Well, Mike Teague, of course. I'm jumping of the guns a little bit.
That's cheating.
That's cheating, right. That's cheating. We won't bother with it.
Understandable.
probably... maybe Gary White. He was a steady player, Gary White, and he was a useful player. Mm. Yeah.
I guess it's between Dave Owen and Gary White, really.
Yeah. I think Gary White probably knew a little bit more about the game. Don't tell that to David Owen, of course. So that would have been roughly my team, I think. Difficult remembering everything, you know.
Yeah. If I were a young fullback coming along and sitting at your knee, Don, what tips would you give me on how to be a better fullback?
Well, somebody told me never let the ball bounce. Now, that's the first thing. Now, that meant positional play. How do you get into position? Well, you always watch the halfbacks. And you look and you see if he's left-handed, right-handed, left-footed, right-footed. That's the first thing. Because when we played, this an example, when we played Northampton, they had a centre who would sidestep off his left leg, which was very unusual. It was against the wave. You know, you'd go up and you keep on his inside normally. But a chap who stepped off his left foot was very difficult. So you, I as a fullback, I realised that the people who were going to kick would generally scrum half down the short side. The outside half would either kick down the middle or you'd try and kick open in those days. And so I was reading them, what they were doing, where they were going. And that, to me, was the key. So by reading their positional play, I was not letting the ball bounce. And if the, you know, everyone sort of said very kindly that he was quite good at the high balls and his hands were good and so forth. I must have had good hand-eye coordination. But it came of knowing who was going to do what and when. And that was brilliant. If you knew that, you're a... So any youngster, I would say, if you're in the centre, well, you've got to look at... Yeah, I think you've still got to look at probably the outside half and the scrum half, but not as hard as you would as a full-back.
At various points in this chat, we've talked about your goal-kicking, but I'd like to sort of specifically talk about that. Can you talk us through your technique as a goal-kicker?
Well, don't forget, there's a leather ball. We run straight, we don't run round the corner. The ball is angled at, what's that, off the ground, say 45 degrees for argument's sake. And the idea was to get your measured run up, eyes down, follow through. That was, I was saying to myself, psychologically, the wider the kick, the easier it was. Because if you missed, you said, well, nobody expected me to get it over. If it was in front of the post or near the post and you missed it, you thought, oh, bugger. You know, so I did a lot of practice, but the pitches in those days were not very good as a rule, and a leather ball, sometimes the leather balls were very wet and slippery, so it was quite difficult. I do envy the present kickers, but it's a nice sort of ball nowadays.
It's a different ball altogether,
pitch,
isn't it?
Yeah. So I used to practice regularly. I certainly had days where I couldn't miss, and days when I knew I would miss, and I don't know why it was. It was just one of those things.
Do you think it was the concentration? You really got the concentration on
it? I think I was concentrated, but again, the psychology of kicking. I mean, that's why I'm a great admirer of Wilkinson. Doesn't matter where it is, I keep saying to myself, 3 points. You know, and I know what he's going through, but he's got a priceless technique and temperament. Yeah. And that is the secret. You can have a very good technique, but if you don't have the right temperament, or something goes wrong and you just can't correct it, you know, and you don't have time. The 80 minutes of rugby and that's it. So there was days when I was absolutely unbelievably good and other days when I thought I was bloody awful, you know.
What was the relationship with the committee like at Gloucester when you were there?
No problem. We met on a Monday, I think it was, for the selection. There's Hudson the father, what do they call him again?
Arthur Hudson.
Is it? No.
Or Gordon.
Might have been Gordon at one stage. Because Arthur was much older.
Yes, oh, Arthur was much older.
Yes,
yeah.
I think
he was sort of grand old man.
The Reverend Mervyn Hughes was on the committee.
Yeah.
The captain was on the committee. There must have been the second team captain as well. I probably was on it as well. I don't know if I can remember who else was on it, but it was very amicable. And I bowed to them in a way because they knew more about their players in one sense than I did, you know, because they were living in Gloucester and they were working with them and so forth. And generally there was very few changes in the team. So it was quite an amicable thing. And then the team was announced and that was it. Then as the captain in particular, I'd start getting them thinking. And no end of Mickey taking it, so forth. It's good fun.
Did you get to know Tom Voice?
I did a little bit. Tom Voice was... Well, he stressed how important it was at Gloucester, the game of rugby. Well, I soon realised that, you know. And I think he was on the RFU committee when I joined the RFU.
He was on the RFU committee until 1971.
Yeah. No, I was there. I joined 69, August 69. Mm. So he was on for a short while. Yeah, he knew who I was and I knew who he was. But we didn't have too many words to say, you know. There was nothing about it, just one of those things.
Yeah. Let's just move... Oh, no, before we do that, end of season tours. I think you normally went down to the West Country.
Well, there were all.
Is this why you live in Penzance now?
No, nothing to do with that. Sure, sure.
Never came back.
Oh, I thought you'd be left behind.
No. They always wanted me to come on. They say, you must come on an Easter tour, Darn. And I used to say, yes. Why is that? Because we used to play Penzance and on the way back Exeter. And I was at Wycliffe and I was barking some books. And I got on the coach at Kingsholm with my books. You know, I was a very serious sort of bloke. And I must have looked twice, because the middle of the coach on either side, the seats had been taken out, those barrels of beer. And I thought, bloody hell, what's this going to be like? You know, because we've got to win in these games. And I'm sitting at the front. By the time we got to Bristol, or certainly not Exeter, the barrels of beer were empty. I always remember Mickey Booth, when for some reason Terry Hobson didn't play at Penzance. I played outside half, and every time Mickey Booth, he bent down to put the ball in the scrum, I thought he was going to collapse. You know, he'd had so much to drink, and I thought, God, he's not going to come up. And so that was quite an experience. And the other one, we stayed at the Lugger on the seafront at Penzance, which obviously I know now. And I, as the captain, I said, now lads, we've got to take these games very seriously, we've got to win, you know, the usual story, let's go to bed. So, right, good idea. And I thought, oh, that's brilliant. So I goes up, and they're all coming up with me, and they went to the bedrooms. Next morning I discovered, after about 15 minutes, they'd all gone back downstairs again to continue their drink. So, yeah, that was some of the experiences on tour. But oh dear, Easter tours in those days, because Penzance used to get Cardiff Guy's Hospital, all sorts of people were on tour. And I still meet what they call them, Barnes, the fullback for, well, Penzance and our dear. And we sort of chatted about it, you know. And he said, "Ah, you played outside Arthur." Yes. I said, yeah, and I just survived. I think we just won, actually, as well.
Well, there can't be too many people who remember you as an outside half.
No, that's true. No, it wasn't by choice. It was in circumstances. I don't know what Hobson had done at that time, but he wasn't playing. Yeah. Maybe he came in on the Monday against Exeter. He certainly didn't play against Penzance on that trip.
Who did you used to share a room with on tour?
I cannot remember.
Well, it's probably a good thing if they didn't make that much of an impression on you.
Yeah, I probably went to bed and dropped asleep, and they'd pull me up after going out and back on the pub. No, I honestly can't remember that.
Right.